That brings us to today, which you will hopefully already have noticed, according to the syllabus, involves two different exercises. So we're continuing the Drosophila saga. That's part of it. That's the more important, the more urgent part of today. The other exercise, though, was exercise 8, which is the plasmid mapping exercise. Now, I'm going to talk about that today to hopefully explain it. But just like the genetics of maize, this doesn't have to be part of your notebook until the end of the term. So if you don't have a perfect grasp on it today, no big deal. Don't knock yourself out trying to get it done by next week, especially if you have other stuff more urgent to think about. You eventually need to have those. It's a set of problems, really. You need to eventually have those problems worked out in your notebook by the time I get around to the second check, which will be at the end of the term. Okay. So let me first talk about the Drosophila experiments, because remember, it's two dual experiments. We have our flies back now. We really skipped. We didn't perform the second part, which we do in some terms, depending on what the holiday calendar is. But this time around, since we didn't meet last week because of Labor Day, we had the staff do what you normally would have done the second week, which was to remove the parents, not sterilize them. There's no mention of sterilization anywhere in the protocols. So that's already been done for you. The parents have been removed. And therefore, the flies that you see remaining in your vials from 2 weeks ago are the F1 offspring, right? The parents have been removed. We've removed those parents so that they wouldn't mate with their children, which would confuse things genetically. So we want to remove these adult or young adult F1s today as part of the ongoing experiment. And so one part that's different about today is that you're going to be doing your own fly napping. I did that for you last time, just to give you flies to look at and put into vials. This time you need to transfer your own flies to napping vials and then nap them before, so that you can look at them, because part of today is to look at phenotypes. You should also get more practice sexing them. So as part of your raw data, you should make a count of how many individuals you have and go ahead and sex them. Say how many males and females there are, but also make a note of what the phenotypes are, what the traits are for each of the characteristics that you pay attention to in each of the two experiments. Right? Each experiment features two characteristics you care about. You need to write down what the trait is for each of those two characteristics. So you're going to be dealing with multiple vials. First of all, you have 4 vials that you're going to pick up because you made each experiment in duplicate. That's the two vials of the same type are really identical. The flies will be pooled together. And so regardless of the fact that the protocol tells you to make 6 new vials, you're making 2 vials, not 6. You're not even making 4 because you're going to put all the adults from both duplicates of the same experiment into one new vial that you make tonight. So just like I told you last week, make sure when you make the new vial with new food medium that you use those vials, not these. But since you're also doing napping, you will use these napping vials. I don't want to see anyone napping the vials that have food in them from last time. That's not where you put them to sleep. You're just going to make a mess of things, and you're going to end up killing some of your flies. So you need to get your flies from the tube they're in right now into napping vials that don't have anything in them. It's just plastic before you add the anesthetic. All right? Now, doing that, hopefully not allowing any flies to escape, involves taking a napping vial and a napping cap, and then what the vial that you're trying to empty, And you shouldn't expect to get every last fly into this first napping vial, but you can do it in stages. You can make as many napping vials as you want from this one until you get all the adults out. Hopefully it'll be easy because we didn't use the netting that it recommends you putting in, which usually makes it harder to get them all out. That's why I told you not to put it in. But you have adults running around in here. You also have empty pupil cases or puparia. Don't think that those are things you need to get out. Those are just empty bags at this point. The adults are the things running around. And like the manual says, these things instinctively try to crawl upwardly. So what I do to transfer these things to a napping vial is to have the vial ready, first of all. And I just lightly tap it a couple times to just make them fall to the bottom. But they're immediately going to crawl up. So as soon as you have them down away from the lid, you can take the lid off and immediately put this inverted napping vial on top so none can escape. Okay? You have to imagine this foam one is no longer here. All right? And then holding those two together, turn the whole duplex upside down with them still sealed. And then tap it again lightly. Lightly is important because you don't want to dislodge any of the food, which will happen if you try to tap it too hard or too many times. So just a few taps usually will drop most of them. Don't worry if there's a couple still in there. Like I said, you can do it again with a new vial. But as soon as they're dropped down in here, they're going to want to crawl back up to where the food is vertically. So separate the two, have this stopper at the ready. Put it in this napping tube and then put the original clean food one back in because you'll still have some left in here probably. All right? And then just ignore this until you nap these. You can then go back and do this again. But you want to get all your adults out. Now, if there are dead adults, you're sure that they're dead because they're embedded in food or whatever from last week, don't worry about getting them out. They're not going to mate if they're dead and you don't have to get those out. But once you have you have to imagine there's a bunch of flies in this napping vial. They're not going to just volunteer to nap. You have to administer the anesthetic, right? Which you have to do over in the hood. So don't bring the fly nap bottles out of the hood. Go over there to do the napping. Doesn't matter which bottle you use. They're all the same. But there are several different brushes, just little wires with bristles at the end that you need to dunk. Don't forget to dunk those into the jar because you need to have enough anesthetic to knock them out pretty quickly. But once you have a wet brush, just knock them down again so they're not right by the stopper. Push the stopper over a little bit with your finger so you can get the bristle head all the way into the tube and then just let go and that'll seal it so they can't get out. The wire will just be stuck there with the bristles in the air and they're going to get a little woozy. But here's where you can't get distracted because it only takes about a minute. And you don't want to kill any of these because that'll ruin the rest of your experiment. You need the next generation to exist, which means you need these to mate. So wait about a minute, but usually at about 30 seconds or so, I'll tap it down again because by then enough of them start to get kind of out of it that they'll just kind of pile up and you'll have some of them still move away from that pile. But that allows you to monitor them basically better. And then at about a minute, I do that again. And usually by then, the whole mass will just be, they might be twitching a little bit, but they'll just be in a pile. They'll no longer be walking. If you do have a couple more walking, it's fine to go a couple more seconds, you know, to let them down. But even when there's a couple walking, it's probably safe to take the brush out, leaving the stopper in place because there's still plenty of anesthetic in the air to knock them out. But once they're all basically in a pile, not walking around, then take the stopper out. And I forgot to mention that you should already at this point have a pre-labeled index card saying which experiment it is because you definitely do not want to mix up the two experiments, which is easy to do because they will probably look alike for reasons that might be already obvious to you based on Punnett Square predictions. All right? So have the index card labeled with which cross it is, and another one labeled the other way. But spill them out onto the card so that now they're in fresh air. They won't get any deeper. They won't be in danger of dying. And they'll stay anesthetized long enough for you to take a look at them, sex them, and count them for your raw data. But as soon as you're done looking at them and counting them, you should put all of them from the same experiment, which is two vials worth, into one new vial. So don't do any of this stuff unless you already have a vial made. That means one person from each group should start right away making two brand new vials from the clean ones. And just like last time, only allow them to set up and then put them on their side. Once they're set up, keep them on their side because you don't want the flies to touch them. So when it comes time to transferring them in, just like last week, do that. But before that happens, make sure you fully label, you know, do all the work on a tube so you don't have to mess with it. So it can just be in place when it's time to put the flies in. Already have the tape on it and everything. Hopefully we got more tape. We were running short of it yesterday. But if you don't have tape in your little plastic bin, then just borrow with each other, because I don't know where they keep the new rolls. It's one of my problems. I don't stock the thing. Okay? So like I said, it's no big deal if you have to use multiple napping vials to empty the one vial. Just combine them all in the end from the same experiment. That's really all there is to continuing the Drosophila experiment. The other part has to do with the mapping exercise. And one major topic that has to do with this mapping exercise is restriction enzymes, which is why it's called restriction enzyme mapping as an exercise. Restriction enzymes, of course, are enzymes, but more specifically, they are examples of nucleases. Now, the word nuclease should indicate to you that we're talking about an enzyme because it ends in ASE, right? Even more specifically, these nucleases are examples of endonucleases because there are two major types of nucleases. A nuclease in general is simply an enzyme that can digest or dismantle a nucleic acid by breaking phosphodiester bonds, which are the kinds of bonds that hold together adjacent nucleotides within a polynucleotide or nucleic acid. So you have these, for instance, as part of your digestive enzymes, because you know, the food you eat has nucleic acids in it. But anyway, there are endonucleases and there are exonucleases. Exo means out of, endo means within, right? The difference is that an exonuclease will cut just the terminal nucleotide off of the sequence. It'll take one off of the end and keep doing that over and over, but it's always taking one off of the end. Whereas an endonuclease will cut somewhere in the middle of the overall nucleic acid. And that's what we're talking about today in this mapping exercise. So these restriction enzymes can be called that, or they can be called restriction endonucleases, more descriptively. And these are naturally occurring enzymes that do their job naturally in the organisms that produce them, but we have kind of co-opted them for biotechnological purposes to do various things that are useful in working with DNA. What are the organisms, though, in which these endonucleases naturally occur? Where do we find these things in nature? Well, I know. It's in bacteria. Bacteria evolved restriction endonucleases as a way to protect themselves. They needed to protect themselves against attack by viruses or viri. Now, there are all kinds of different viri, but what general name do we give to a virus that specifically invades a bacterium? Yes, which is short for bacteriophage. A bacteriophage is not a bacterium. A bacteriophage is a virus that specializes in invading bacteria specifically. Other viri have other hosts. Now, a virus is a pretty simple device. It's not an organism. And why is it not an organism? Doesn't meet the requirement for the important criterion for being an organism, which is what?
It has to depend on another.
Well, it's true that viruses have to depend on other things to do the various things that we call living. They're not really alive. They are biotic entities, which means they have to do with life. But they are not an organism, back to the original question, for one important reason. And that's because they don't include at least one cell, which you have to be an organism officially. So the bacterium is an organism. The bacteriophage is not. A virus is really just a couple macromolecules. It's a nucleic acid, usually DNA, but sometimes RNA, wrapped by a protein. So two of the four macromolecule types, right, is what a virus is, and that's really it. A bacteriophage operates by coming up to the, when it is in contact with a bacterium, the DNA, assuming it's a DNA virus, will be injected into the interior of the bacterium, leaving the protein behind. Now, once that DNA is in the bacterium, that DNA performs both of its two important functions that we've been talking about, which are transcription and replication, right? It'll be replicated, which means now, instead of just having one viral DNA piece, you have several identical viral DNAs. The viral DNA is not a complete virus, though. So that's just DNA. It's incapable of infecting another bacterium. But it's a piece of DNA, and like pieces of DNA, it has genes on it, protein-coding genes. And so after it's replicated, the copies of that viral DNA are then transcribed by the bacterial machinery. And when that messenger RNA gets produced by transcription, it will then be translated using the bacterial ribosomes. And what kind of proteins do you suppose will be produced when that is, when that messenger RNA is transcribed? The very proteins that are the rest of the virus. You've already made the DNA copies. Then when you transcribe that DNA, you make and translate the mRNA, you make the proteins that the viral DNA is coded in, and now you have complete viruses inside the bacterium. And that can happen to the extent of having so many copies that it basically explodes the bacterium, so that these now copied viruses can go infect other bacteria. So that it destroys the cell. And if you're a bacterium, you can't afford to lose a cell because you have only one cell. So there's strong selection pressure for something evolutionarily to come along to deal with this problem. And that's why endonucleases did evolve. Endonucleases that the bacteria produce are able to cut that viral DNA when it gets injected into small pieces so that it no longer functions as genes and therefore can't be assembled into new viruses. All right? Now, there are all kinds of different examples of restriction endonucleases. Each different species of bacteria makes its own version. They all work basically the same way. They cut a nucleic acid somewhere internally, which is why they're endonucleases, but where they cut depends on the specific version. And they don't just cut randomly internally. Each individual kind of endonuclease cuts at a specific little sequence of nucleotides that it's able to recognize, if it's there at all. If it's not there, then that piece of DNA will not be cut by that particular endonuclease. But if somewhere in that long sequence of nucleotides, there is a short sequence that it recognizes, or maybe several instances of that short sequence, then it will be cut at that place. And we call those little short sequences that the restriction endonucleases recognize restriction sites or recognition sites. And they are usually about 6 nucleotides long, 6 base pairs long, not very long sequences. Why does that make sense? Well, the longer a sequence you have that has to be recognized, the less likely it's going to be that some sample of DNA is just going to randomly contain that sequence. The shorter the sequence is, the more likely it is that some random piece of viral DNA will include that specific sequence. So they are short sequences, so they'll work. They'll cut the thing into many pieces. And so it's the restriction sites, those short sequences, that are different for each of the different kinds of restriction endonucleases. What they have in common, though, is that these restriction sites are examples of palindromes, genetic palindromes. Now, aside from genetics, what does palindrome mean, just in everyday usage? What is a palindrome? Yeah. Exactly. A palindrome reads the same backwards as forward. So there are many linguistic examples, like mom, or a Toyota, or race car. Or a couple famous examples that are a little bit longer are a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. Same backwards as forward. Or one that has to do with the exile of Napoleon is Abel was I, ere I saw Elba, which is where he was exiled. Same backwards as forward. So those are linguistic palindromes. A genetic palindrome is a little bit different because DNA is double-stranded, right? More than that, it is anti-parallel. It's complementary and it's anti-parallel, which means the 3-5 to 5 prime direction in one strand is the opposite direction compared to the 3-5 to 5 prime direction in the other strand. So you can easily create any palindrome you want. Like, for instance, if I write down ATG, and we have to assume that that's after thousands and thousands of other nucleotides that come before, represented by the ellipsis, then in the other strand, we would have to have ATG in reading right to left in the other position, and therefore, just by complementarity rules, you can fill out everything else. So that whole thing, ATGCAT on the top, TACGTA on the bottom, is a palindrome because the bottom strand reads the same as the top strand, but in the reverse direction. And all these restriction sites are palindromes, usually about 6 nucleotides long. So when a particular, you know, if we pretend that our restriction enzyme, that particular version of the restriction enzyme, recognizes this palindrome in particular, that's the only place it will cut DNA. Won't cut it at all if it doesn't find any instances, but if it finds multiple instances, it'll cut it the same way at each of those sites. And there's 2 fundamentally different ways it can cut the restriction site. It could cut it just right in the middle, for instance. And that would produce 2 pieces of double-stranded DNA, where there was one. And both of those pieces would have what we call blunt ends, because neither strand within that fragment is longer than the other. They're still both the same size. Those ones, biotechnologically, are less useful. So we usually use restriction enzymes that make what is called a staggered cut, like this, for instance. It's symmetric, radially symmetrical cut, but it's staggered. And so now, of course, there's two double-stranded fragments that are produced when you have a staggered cut, too. This right half will be separate from this left half, but each of them will have what are called sticky ends rather than blunt ends, because one of the two strands will be longer than the other, and therefore will have some nucleotides that are not complementarily bonded to anything else. They're just hanging there, wanting to form hydrogen bonds with the complement. Okay? The reason that is useful is that if we have two totally different pieces of DNA from totally unrelated organisms, for instance, but we subject them to the same endonuclease, and assuming that both of those samples of DNA have a recognition site in them that enzyme will recognize, then they'll be cut exactly the same way. And one of the pieces will have a sticky end that is exactly complementary to one of the pieces from the other source of DNA. And when you combine them, they will just naturally hybridize and go back together. Now you have a piece of DNA that's part one organism and part another organism. This is the basis of recombinant DNA technology. We use these endonucleases for that purpose and for several other purposes. It's basically a way to manageably work with DNA, because we usually don't, you know, when we work with DNA, we usually, first of all, amplify it so we have many, many copies, enough to work with. But we usually don't amplify an entire chromosome's worth of DNA. We're usually interested in just a little piece of it. Well, we cut it selectively by subjecting it to restriction enzymes, another major use of it. So that's the background. Now to the actual exercise, which is for plasmid mapping. And this is the PDF that you should have looked at for today. We'll go over the sample exercise, but then there are 10 or so problems that those are the ones that eventually need to be in your notebook. Let me explain the rationale, though. The blue box here represents an electrophoresis gel. Electrophoresis is a basic separation technique used in science to separate things based on charge, shape, and size. And so if you have a sample that is a mixture of particles of different size and shape and charge, they will move through the electrophoresis gel at different rates and therefore move different distances in the same amount of time. So a gel has lanes in it. These are the vertical columns, basically. And each lane will have some number of bands in it. Each band represents a collection of fragments of the same size that therefore have moved at the same speed and reached the same distance. Smaller particles electrophorese more easily than larger ones. So you start out at the wells at the top, but the bands that move the farthest from the wells are the smallest ones, which you can verify by looking at the numbers on the right here. These are numbers from a standard that are used to indicate the sizes of each of these bands in the unknown lanes. Okay? Now, we're working, the DNA samples that we're using here are plasmids. And hopefully you're already familiar with plasmids, but plasmids are small circular pieces of DNA. Kind of like a miniature version of a prokaryotic chromosome. Prokaryotic chromosomes are circular, unlike eukaryotic chromosomes, which are linear. The reason I'm bothering to mention that is because if you have a circular piece of DNA and you cut it once, how many pieces do you have?
One.
Right, all you're doing is opening up the loop. Now you've turned it into a linear chromosome. Whereas if you take one of our chromosomes and cut it once, you have two pieces. Okay? In fact, if you cut it zero times, you have one piece. Either way, you have one piece, cutting it once or zero. To get two pieces, you'll have to cut it twice. Now, each individual lane within the gel represents a different digest These are called digests because we're exposing this plasmid, and it's the same plasmid on the entire gel for each of the different problems. It's a different plasmid each problem, but within one gel, each lane, it uses the same plasmid. But it's a different digest because in each lane, we're exposing the plasmid to a different set of restriction enzymes. And that same plasmid, therefore, will be cut differently in the different digests. The idea is we want to try to figure out where the restriction sites are on the plasmid. This can be valuable information. For instance, if you are engineering a plasmid, you want to know where you can easily insert other genes into that existing plasmid so that you can, for instance, put those genes into bacteria to fool bacteria into making some protein you want to manufacture. All right, like insulin, that's how insulin is made nowadays rather than getting it from pigs. Anyway, that's what the mapping exercise is, to try to figure out where on this plasmid the recognition sites are for the various kinds of restriction endonucleases that you're exposing these plasmids to. And it's mostly a logic problem. So notice that each lane has a header on it by the well with a different code, basically. These codes are how we name these restriction enzymes. It's really just a string of letters that represents the initial of the genus and then the first few letters of the species and then maybe a Roman numeral or something, which is why we have, for instance, ECO-R1. The ECO part of that is short for Escherichia coli, E. coli. And similarly for the other ones. That just is the genus and species of the bacterium from which we get that particular endonuclease. Now, the two blank ones we can ignore, but the first used lane here is a single digest, meaning that the plasmid was exposed to just one type of endonuclease, which is why it's named just HIND3, just one enzyme type. And notice that produced one band. Now, you might be thinking that means there's either zero cut or one cut. And I can tell you that early on in the problems, because they kind of build in difficulty, that is kind of a safe assumption. But one band does not necessarily mean one fragment. Here's why. If you have a plasmid, and let's say there's a restriction site right here that the enzyme can recognize, it will cut it there. If there's another of that same recognition site exactly halfway around the circle, again, diametrically opposed from it, it will cut it there as well. And so you do have two fragments, but in this case, those fragments are identical in length. So they will electrophorese at exactly the same speed, and they will form one band. I'm mentioning this because after you get through the easier problems at the beginning, you might come upon one that doesn't seem to make sense or you can't solve. Then you have to keep in mind that in some instances, one band could actually mean two different fragments of the same size. Okay? But not for these first few. So, on this example one, what we're assuming here by this one band is that the plasmid was cut just one time. You have one piece, and you can see that it's 50 base pairs in length by looking at the number on the right. That's why the first step is to draw yourself the plasmid, which is a circle, and put a 50 in the middle representing that it's 50 total base pairs in circumference. So one trip all the way around the circle is 50. That's what that means. Therefore, halfway around the circle would be 25. 3/5 of the way around the circle would be 30, and so on. But we get that 50 from the size of this band. The lane next to that is another single digest, but we've changed enzymes now. Here we're using ECO-R1, which has a different restriction site. So you kind of put this first circle to the side and make a brand new one, And you can still assume it's 50 because it's the same plasmid. Okay? But now it's going to be cut a greater number of times because this digest produced three bands. So now you have a band that's 30 base pairs, one that's 15, and one that's 5. Okay, and notice that those add up to 50, which makes sense, right? Assuming that all of these bands represent just one fragment type. So, by the way, we put a little tick mark for the first one, the green one, just at noon. We have no idea where that occurred. Just by convenience, we put it at noon, the first cut. And similarly for the second one, this isn't a cut that occurred in the same place, but we're going to put it at noon to begin with for that first cut, so that it's just a reference place. We need to cut this 50, though, into, 30, 15, and 5. So counting the noon position as 0, 30 would be 3/5 of the way around, since the whole trip around is 50. So that's why the second red tick mark was made right here. This is 30, and that leaves this to be 20. So to agree with the data, we have to add another tick mark that will break that 20 into a 5 and a 15. So now we have 30, 5, and 15. Those represent the three bands for that lane. Agrees with the data. All right, now the next part is that we need to explain the data in this third lane, which is a double digest. So now the plasmid is simultaneously exposed to both different types of endonuclease. And notice that four bands result in this case. So four pieces, 20, 15, 10, and 5. And here's where actually doing one of these two circles on a piece of transparency would actually help. But you can imagine what you would do with the transparency, hopefully, with this explanation. So you have the red one that's shown in the second, the red one that has three tick marks on it, this one. You have that done on paper. And then you have the green one, which just has one tick mark on a piece of transparency. And you match them up, first of all, noon to noon. So this green one would be right on top of this red one. We know that that's not true because the different kinds of enzymes are not going to recognize the same site. So the idea is to swivel the transparent one. You're looking at the other one through it. Really what you're doing is moving that green tick mark around the circle until you find some place where it will agree with this double digest lane. And the way that worked here is that if you put the tick mark here for the green, that breaks the 30 up into a 10 and 20, and you still have the 15 and the 5. So now 10, 20, 15, and 5 agrees with this data, with these data. Does that make sense? Okay, that's the same rationale that you use in all the problems. They just get a little bit more complicated, and eventually they throw in the fact that a single band can represent two fragments, so beware of that. But that's what you do for all of these. Like I said, there's plenty of time to do this, so you don't even have to really think about this much for a while if you don't want to. But expect it to take a while to get through the problems eventually. So you might want to do it in batches. Get the feel for it, and then put it off for a while, and when you have time, get back to it. But no need to have this as part of your notebook anytime soon. There was one other thing I wanted to say, and that it's possible for there to be multiple equally viable possibilities. Like, for instance, when this second red tick mark was added here to represent the 30, it could have been over here, and the 30 on the left and the 20 on the right. Those are equally viable, right? We don't have any idea which one is true. That's why we need more data. And even if you do assume that the 30 is on the right, the third tick mark could be up here by this one or down here by this one, breaking the 20 into 15 and 5 instead of 5 and 15. So there's multiple possibilities, but don't worry about multiple possibilities. All you need to do is come up with one that agrees with the data for each of the problems. Any questions on it? In that case, let's work with flies. Oh, remember, you're the last section, so you do have to put the scopes away tonight. today?